Hello and welcome back to the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast. I am your host, Wade Wojcik, joined by David Ishida.
Hello.
And the late, the great, oh no.
He is late.
He's late and he's very great in that he actually died this time. No, Ben is out of town today, so he couldn't join us, which is unfortunate because I really wanted him to be here for, especially for our third segment when we talk about the movie that we all saw. But exciting times, NAB.
NAB.
The late, the great NAB. David, you went to NAB this year?
I did. It was a lot of fun.
And we're going to talk about the three top things that you enjoyed from their showcase. After that, we are going to talk about establishing shots, setting up a scene within a frame, and how that can be effectively done and how it can be poorly done, and comparing two different styles of filmmaking that we like and then don't like. And then this month, we saw an older film, but one that is worth talking about, King Arthur.
It's weird to think that that was like 14 years ago.
Yeah.
That came out.
Yeah, indeed. Clive Owen still looks the same. I saw a preview for him when I saw Guardians of the Galaxy 2 the other day. Did you see that one?
Guardians of the Galaxy 2?
Yeah.
No.
Oh, aside. Anyway, I'm not talking about that this episode. This is episode 11, I do believe.
Almost there.
Almost next, to next a month. Year. So, kicking it right off, NAB 2017. What was kind of the big trend of this year?
Well, this year was the year of lenses. For those of you who don't know, NAB is the National Association of Broadcasters, and NAB Show is the National Association of Broadcasters Show. It is every year in Vegas. It is one of the big three industry trade shows, if you will, of the year, followed by CineGears and IBC. And this year, and so this is where all the newest and the best gear is usually unveiled and shown off from every aspect of the film and TV industry, not ranging from just hardware, but also software and satellite trucks and grip equipment and IP things and storage and everything you can think of. Every little minute detail of the industry is shown off here. So there's a lot of people. There's probably about 120,000 people that are at this show, and it does take up the entire Las Vegas Convention Center. If you've ever been there, you know how big that space is, and it is in all three areas, North, Central, and South Halls.
Wow. So you said this is the year of lenses. The first one we were going to talk about was the Vista?
Yes, the Tokina Vista lenses. So as I was saying, with this being the year of lenses, there were very few cameras, new cameras coming out. Like none of them from the big makers had anything really major of note that came out. And what is now becoming the trend that we're also seeing with the lenses is covering larger and larger sensors. There aren't that many large sensors out there. Like, you know, usually for most people, the largest sensor an average Joe would come across would be a full frame sensor, like on a 5D. And at this point, really, the only common one larger than that, even though it's very uncommon, is the Red VistaVision sensor. And it's almost as wide as full frame. I think it's a little bit narrow.
Your hands were about a foot apart. I thought, Jesus Christ, this thing is huge.
And the other one other than that is the Alexa 65, which is a full 65 millimeter sensor, which is gargantuan.
Wow.
But that one, like, people don't buy that. You have to rent that from Arri. Yeah, so you can't own it. And it also uses special lens mounts. So that one doesn't really count. So we're at this this point of almost a cart before the horse situation where the sensors haven't, you know, as I said, there are not many cameras that have large format sensors yet. There are a few, but now lenses are going and jumping to cover that because they all feel like, you know, something like a 70 millimeter or 65 millimeter sensor is very close on the horizon to become the common sensor size.
Sure.
Like Super 35 is today, and then in the future, you know, 65 millimeter will be the new Super 35, and Super 35 will be the new 16.
Kind of like how we have cameras that do 8K but no 8K TVs.
Yep. Exactly.
Gotcha.
Well, of course, I saw some 8K TVs at NAB.
All right. But so this set looks like it comes with 18 millimeter, 25 millimeter, 35 millimeter, 50, and then an 85. Pretty comprehensive. That's a good set.
Yep, it's a pretty full set. You know, to round it out really well, they should have done a 100 or a 135. But this is a new set, and what makes this special, because there were, as I said, with other new lenses, there was also the Zeiss CP3s, which is an update to their CP2 line, which are the lenses we shot Dawn Under Heaven on, or the CP2s. And then we had Sigma, who makes some really great DSLR lenses, came out with their own cinema set. With both of them, with both Zeiss and Sigma, they look great. There's nothing wrong with them, but they're both based on photo lenses. and the optics of them are just photo lenses that have been rehoused in the cinema style. Tokinas, on the other hand, are from the ground up for cinema. So they're brand new optics that are completely redesigned. So they're not just rehousing one of the other lenses they make. And with this, they are designed to cover VISTA, as the name implies, VISTA vision sensor. So I believe the image circle, let me see if I can find that, the image circle is 46.7 millimeters. So, you know, that being that when the light comes through the lens and it's hitting the sensor, that's how round the image is.
Sure.
It's 46 millimeters in diameter. And that covers the VISTA vision sensor from RED, which is 45, I think. So you got a little room to spare.
Interesting. So how do these stack up to, say, the Canon Cinema Prime lenses?
So these would be very similar in many ways. The Canons are also, like, they were from ground up made for cinema. So they are also like this. And those, the Canon ones can all cover full frame. So the capable image circle will be very, very similar.
Okay. So maybe these... Are these more expensive? Are these cheaper?
These are about the same price. They're about $4,000 or $5,000 per lens. So, like, they're not cheap. They're not like the Rokinons we talked about back in episode one, two,
three, four. So it was back there a ways.
Yep. So it's in another level. So for a lot of people, this will be something that will be a rental house option.
Sure.
But they are very capable. They're all very fast. They're all 1.5, which makes for very fast lens, which is about where a lot of the Canons are. The Canons are like 1.5, 1.3 for the main focal lengths. So they are very useful because they're future resistant is what I call tech like this. Like, nothing is future proof. That doesn't exist. But there's future resistant, so things that you can get a lot of longevity out of because they're built that way.
Right.
And so that's where these come into play. And so these look really, really nice. There was a short shot on them called the Dispatcher, and that was directed by Phil Holland, who is a very well-known figure in the RED community for RED cameras. And I believe it had a plane on the background at the Tokina booth. And apparently day one, a Netflix rep walked by and watched it and said, "I want to buy that right now."
Wow.
And the Netflix, and they bought, I think, I don't know the rights for it. I don't know.
That's very cool.
Yeah. So that was fun.
Goes a ways to kind of illustrate the importance of look given to you by, in large part, by a lens.
Yep.
That's awesome.
Yep. And it's also, you know, with anything, it's always worth trying a lens. If you have the opportunity to try it, I highly recommend that.
So then also you brought up a new 360 cam.
Yes. So 360 is a thing that really came up last year, is when we started to see common 360 cameras. So 360 camera being... a camera or camera array that is capturing in all directions. And this year was no different. There was more of those around. And this is the Insta360 Pro. So this is a Chinese company, and they have several other 360 cameras that they have come out with already, most of them being cell phone based. So you plug them into your phone, and then it uses your phone as the main, as like the viewfinder and the viewing system.
I'm just looking at their page now. It's pretty impressive what they can do. They show optical flow stitching and transitional template-based stitching. So it's basically where the edges of the cameras around the sphere, where their edges intersect, they do a really good job of combining the images into one continuous flowing image, as opposed to having, you know, kind of like a ghosting shape.
Right, exactly. And when I saw it live, it actually, like, I did still see ghosting, but they do say that it is better to dump the footage and restitch it on your computer. It can do it in camera, but it's better to do it on a computer.
It's impressive to see it as like a contained sphere and not like this wonky rig of a bunch of GoPros.
Yep. So yeah, it's about the size of a cantaloupe. Or so is how big it is. And what is impressive about this one is, one, the price. It's only $3,400.
Wow.
For this system. And it shoots 8K.
And
3D 8K too. So if you have like if you have Google Cardboard or anything that has a split screen, or you have a Vive headset, it will be stereoscopic.
Okay, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Yeah, and it looks like it does 100 frames per second high speed.
Yep, at 4K.
At 4K.
But yeah, but that's still really impressive for it. And I
want this thing now. Looking at it.
Yeah, I'm really hoping CineQuip gets it. I think we will, because we want a higher resolution camera for 360.
Yeah.
And it's going to be very interesting to see how all 360 technology is going to evolve in the future. Because, you know, in 360, you can't hide anything. Mm-hmm. You can't have a crew. You can't have lights, you know, to light a scene, because everyone, you know, you see everything. So you either have to, like, paint it out, you know, something like that, do a lot of time in post to get rid of things. Or we're going to come into this new era, especially in lighting, of having to create lights that look like normal lights.
Mm.
that, you know, that have correct color temperature and correct color quality,
yeah,
or the enough brightness to light a scene.
Yeah.
And so you can hide them in the scene itself.
Right.
You know, and like getting, you know, new kinds of fluorescent tube lights that are actual LEDs,
right,
that have higher output than traditional fluorescents do.
I suppose if you were shooting an indoor scene, you could, you know, depending on the geometry of the space, hide people behind the corners and stuff like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it's going to be interesting because the other thing I haven't seen yet is any kind of 360 camera thing that that where the camera moves, which would be a complicated thing to orchestrate in the first place. But, you know, it's very disorienting if,
yeah,
because your image is moving, but you physically in the real world are not.
On their page here, this is Insta360.com. It shows them moving the camera with stabilization. They call it Insta360 Pro Stabilization.
Yep, it's very impressive. And so, yeah, that's going a long way. And I'm not sure. I couldn't get a sort of a straight answer out of the guy if that's an optical image stabilization or if it is a digital one.
Yeah, that's
now,
a good
as
point.
It is in 8K, it could be digital stabilization and you probably wouldn't really notice.
Yeah, it looks like you have control software via iOS or iPad.
Yep, so you can use any mobile device. You remote into it with an IP address.
Mm-hmm.
So you just use a web browser to get,
gotcha,
into it.
And it looks like there are 4 microphones built in.
Yep, so that's another thing that a lot of bit newer cameras are getting into, because to capture, if you get 4 channels of audio, it helps, and if you have the software that is interpreting it correctly, that when you turn your head or look around, your audio changes.
Yeah.
As it would in real life when you look around, you know, hear differently if you're looking to your right or to your left.
Yeah.
You hear different things or in different ways. So that's the one thing that a lot of things are coming out with, and there were some other makers like Sennheiser made a 360 microphone, which is a microphone with 4 diaphragms for, you know, on it, and then has to go to 4 XLR, so you have to have a 4-channel recorder for it to capture that stereoscopic audio, if you will.
That's cool, man. I love the idea of being able to shoot, even if it wasn't a film, even if it was just like just someone snowboarding down a hill or something simple. It'd be awesome to be able to shoot something myself and then watch it with Google Cardboard, even,
yep,
just like a VR headset.
And another interesting one that I'll just touch on briefly that was teased right before NAB, but it's not out yet, is GoPro is making a 360 camera.
How can they not?
Yep. The GoPro Fusion, it sounds like it's going to be a 6K or 5K camera, mm-hmm, 2 lenses. So that can have its own set of challenges. There can be higher distortion if there's only 2 lenses, whereas it's divided like on that system between 6.
Sure.
But like the way they're almost doing it is like it's not a 360 camera. It captures 360 and it will do 4K or 5K at like 60 frames per second.
Yeah.
But they're almost, their idea being is that you record it and then you pick your framing later. And so you can pan anywhere you want and you pick your, you know, 1080 or whatever cutout.
Interesting.
And do it that way. But I'm sure you could do it as a normal 360 too.
That'd be funny if they just had like your frame just zooming around this 360,
yeah,
dome. Just whoa. That is really cool. I definitely want to learn more about that when it's released. And then finally we have another lens.
Yeah, and it's with the year of lenses, and one thing that has been a long time coming, so lenses and cinema lenses have been getting less and less expensive over the course of the past, call it 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want like the Cook S4 lenses, those brand new, $25,000 per lens. And now you come to what, about 4 years ago or so, Canon Cinema Primes and Zeiss Primes were out for about $4,000 to $6,000 per lens. So they're getting cheaper and cheaper. And the one lens that has not been getting cheaper, though, has been anamorphic. And so anamorphic being the kind that it's not a spherical lens. There's a concave element to it that is squeezing the image down into a smaller area. And then you de-squeeze it in post or on the projector on film cameras or film projector era. And so you get like the big 2:3:8 or whatever aspect ratio, the really wide one, but you don't need, you know, a large format camera,
yeah,
to do it.
And a good example of the reason for these lenses is lens flares.
Yes.
It gives you a nice, gorgeous, horizontally squeezed lens flare. It's,
yep,
not a circular lens flare.
Yep. And also an oval bokeh. Bokeh being the out, like a point of light. When it's out of focus, it gets this fuzzy circle to it.
Mm.
And normally it's a circle. You know, an anamorphic, it's more like an oval.
Right. Helps, it complements the horizontal aspect ratio quite,
mm-hmm,
well.
Yep.
Having that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and normally for these ones, like, you know, if you want to get a Cook anamorphic lens, you're talking about $35,000. You want to get a Zeiss anamorphic, you're talking about $50,000 or $60,000. You know, it's a lot of money. And this year is the first year I saw a quality lens for that's a cheap anamorphic. And, you know, it's still not as cheap as like a Rokinon or anything. But so these are the Atlas Orion anamorphic lenses. They're going to be about $7,000 per lens, and they're coming out first quarter of next year. And these were very impressive looking to me because they looked like very good quality. And another difficult thing in anamorphic is holding focus across the frame. Yeah. Because you have these asymmetrical pieces of glass that are squeezing. It's hard to keep focus the whole way across. An example of a lens that doesn't do that well is SLR Magic came out with some anamorphics that are going to be about the same price, I think about $7,000 or $8,000 per lens, and they look terrible.
Really?
And they lose focus. Like, if not, unless you're in the exact center of frame, it's all out of focus.
Wow.
And then it distorts really badly. Like, if you have any straight lines, like of a building or a picture frame, they're all heavily curved. It looks really bad.
Seems kind of an oversight to have that.
Yeah, and the reviewer on it on No Film School said they looked great and he loved them. And I thought they just look like garbage. Maybe. Unless you're doing a like an artistic, yeah, like an arts piece.
That's
or
what
like
I'm
a
say.
Music video.
Like experimental.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know.
But these ones held focus really nicely across. And the other fun story I have with these lenses is I was looking at them, and then these two guys came up and started talking with the guys who are designing and making these lenses. And the two guys were Gareth Edwards, who is the director of Star Wars Rogue One, and then Greg Fraser, who was the cinematographer for Rogue One.
That's awesome.
So that was pretty cool. They were interested in it, and I got to talk to them briefly. Mm. A little bit about anamorphic stuff, and also the interesting tidbit that they shot Rogue One almost entirely with LED lighting.
Wow.
Which I thought was really interesting.
That's really cool.
Yep.
Great. Well, that is kind of a brief look at some of the highlights from NAB 2017. Coming up, we're going to be talking about establishing shots and setting up a scene within a frame. Be right back. So establishing shots are very important, not only for the beginning of a movie, but the beginning of a scene. Recently, I was thinking about the one that I brought up to you, David, this morning was the establishing shot of A New Hope when Luke leaves. He frustratingly storms out of his home and goes to watch the binary sunset. It's a very iconic scene. It's the first time I think we hear the slow force theme of Star Wars, mm-hmm. the burner, da, 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 da. Yeah, so good.
It gives me shivers.
Yeah,
that
so just the beautiful wide shot of Luke walking up the slight slope behind his house, looking at the binary sunset as they're going down. Very sets up the emotion so well. And then you brought up a couple others like Blade Runner.
Yeah, the there are any number of shots, but one good one is the scene when Deckard, Harrison Ford's character, is going to talk to Mr. Wayland for the first time, and they're going into his large office room,
yeah.
And it's all in that really warm orange lighting, and it's the big giant room, huge windows, and the long conference table, and just the small people as they're walking into the space.
But warm in a sense that it doesn't feel inviting like a warm scene usually might. It feels
alien almost.
It feels like kind of alien and not threatening, but just like you're a little off edge. That's a very cool one.
Mm-hmm. Which then leads you to the discussions and comments later in that very scene, mm-hmm. and sort of some of the revelations about some characters in that scene.
And sorry, but again, not to go back to New Hope, but even just the opening shot of that film, as brought up in the Red Letter Media review of the Star Wars films, is done very, very well, where you have Rebels, Empire, like in the same shot. Rebels, appear very small. The Empire ship appears very large, and it just sums up the struggle like perfectly in that one shot too. Mm-hmm. The obviously what we're kind of dancing around is in establishing wide, if not for a scene, for the beginning of the film, it is the pinnacle of the craft to be able to set up the drama of a story in the opening shot, or at least allude to it or reference it via metaphor in some way, mm-hmm. in the opening shot. That is in my opinion, really good visual storytelling.
Absolutely. Another good example is from the movie Patton, starring George C. Scott. And in that one, it's been parodied many, many times, but it's the opening shot. It's the American flag, and it takes up practically the entire frame. Mm. You can sort of tell you're on a stage. And I've heard, you know, people who have talked about the film, how like seen it in a movie theater, like when it was an American flag that was, you know, 60 feet across, yeah. A very awe-inspiring thing. And then you have Patton come walking up, and then he gets larger and larger in frame. And then you get to all these close-up shots about him and aspects of his character on his uniform. And it's a nice juxtaposition of like, obviously he is a patriot. You know, he's a four-star, ended up being a four-star general. And he's a patriot, but then he steps forward and becomes almost larger than life and takes almost, and this comes in later in the film, and sort of an ego about him at times. And then he takes dominance.
Sure.
In the scene.
Yeah, that's a really cool example. I love the idea of it appearing like a stage, like an auditorium stage or something like that. Because being in the theater, that might seem pretty convincing, right?
Absolutely.
Like the frame itself of the theater is basically the space of the stage. So it feels like you would be in the audience of wherever he is. Mm-hmm. That's very cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think with good establishing shots, especially in the beginning of film, what I think is the best way to do it is something that is visually striking, that evokes some sort of resonance, that is maybe an iconic image that you haven't seen before. Like the Patton one's great, because I'm sure that maybe it's inspired from previous examples, but I don't think that it really plays on to any sort of cliche or you know, pre-existing work that people can point to and say, the old flag and the stage shot, you know, or Star Wars, you know, before A New Hope, you know, it's trying something new that is visually striking that you remember. And I think a lot of films might fall victim to a lazy opening shot that falls upon some uninspired work.
Or a confusing one.
Yeah.
Like one that comes to my mind is, and I'm gonna put it on in the background so Wade can sort of see this unfold, is the opening to Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. So something that had become a thing of the Indiana Jones franchise now with the second film is they have the Paramount logo that fades into a actual mountain of some kind. Which is a thing they did, and I think that's great. But then we're in this Chinese nightclub, and then it goes into this towards this dragon element of a stage, and then we have a musical number.
Yeah,
and in Indiana Jones. Yep, exactly. And you know, it's a fun rendition. It's in Chinese, and so it's entertaining. Mm-hmm. But setting up expectations of the film, like, we're not going to see a musical.
Yeah.
Then it goes into like this whole other, like then they go into the dragon's mouth later and they have a dance number in there and it just doesn't make sense. It's very confusing. And also because they're not even in China for the majority of them, they go to India. This doesn't make any sense. And it confuses me immensely.
You're right. You know what I love about this opening scene is Harrison Ford just kills a bunch of people.
Yeah, absolutely. You spear someone with a shish kebab. Yeah. And
it's funny because the opening shot of Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, it does the same mountain thing, but then it becomes a gopher hole.
Yep, which I feel like could have meant something. I feel like it was supposed to mean something.
Yeah.
But it, like, well, one thing it could be is like, yeah, you thought it was going to be good, but it's not.
I think
you thought it was going to be a mountain, but it's not.
I think there's a reoccurring thing in that movie where there's a lot of elements where you're like, oh, is this going to lead towards something cool? No, it's not at all. By the way, we'd watched this month, King Arthur, you had asked me like, where do I know this guy from? And I said, oh, The Departed. And you're like, no, I haven't seen it. He's also Indiana Jones. And he's Jonesy. No, he's the guy who calls Jones Jonesy. The guy who's like, keeps betraying him.
Oh, that guy. Yeah.
Another great character from that film.
Yeah. Memorable, because I can remember his name.
But anyway, so we'd been talking, recently, mainly I've been talking about Video Game High School just because I have periodic frustrations with Rocket Jump, Freddie W's production company, because I'm not a fan of their style as of late. Anyway, we just recently looked up the opening shot of their web series, the very first frame we see, and it's a very typical Freddie W shot. You have two soldier-like people taking positions with their guns on a warehouse, airport, vacant roof. Looking roof.
Yep.
With vague fire kind of flickering on the side of a wall for some reason. That's clearly composited in.
Yeah.
Very saturated, very high contrast, hyper real. And then it immediately dives right into a firefight, which then we find out is a video game.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's entertaining and it's a cool setup, I guess, but man, it's from an establishing shot perspective, it's just kind of okay, I guess, if you just want to get from A to B and just doesn't really let's
and, not and pay it's attention. Also, you know, so much of opening shot has come through in the cinematography and why you are framing something in some way, and it's just a boring image. It's, you know, it's very bland. It doesn't really say anything with it other than just letting you know there are two people on the roof and there's some fire in the background.
Right, exactly.
But it doesn't tell you anything deeper about it.
I think that's, I mean, not to harp on Freddie W. too much, but I feel like that's his style in general, is just like, here's what we want to show. We don't really want to think about any deeper meaning with this. Mm-hmm. Just here you go. Mm-hmm. Have fun watching this.
And granted, that was very early on in the early days of, if you will, legitimate web series.
Sure.
High production value, you know, put a lot of effort into it. And I compare that to one of my favorite companies in the world, which is Rooster Teeth.
Yeah.
And one of their first forays into a serious drama series was Day 5. And, you know, I highly recommend, the first episode is free on YouTube. I say look it up. And I have waited for here the opening shot, and you see that the earth, and you see it sort of being engulfed in flame. And you don't understand entirely why it's there. And then it's cutting away to a guy lighting up a pipe.
And it's good, like one of those clear glass pipes that maybe has like a globe inside of the glass.
Yeah, exactly.
That's cool.
And with that, it's very simple. It's very short. And it actually cuts to black before it cuts to the person using it.
Yeah.
And it's, again, one of those things you don't know the meaning of it until much later.
Mm.
You know, it's then, you know, as the series progresses, you realize the reason of why that is there's been this sort of apocalyptic event.
Oh, sure.
The world on fire.
Sure. Well, yeah, I think it works well on that level. But just from looking at this opening scene of this man trying to light a pipe and then is frantically searching around his room, I get the sense that maybe his world is on fire in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. That's exactly. Cool. I think that's a well-done opening shot. Is this, when did this come out?
This came out about a year ago is when it came out. And it's five episodes, I think, in the series. Mm-hmm. And the apocalyptic event that's in it is, it's discovered that if you fall asleep, you die. It's people trying to stay awake. And this character basically just came off of a big, you know, drug bender.
Mm.
And he has not realized that this has happened.
That's cool. It definitely has a cool visual style so far.
Also shot on anamorphic lenses.
How do you like the series?
Very good. You know, it's been very interesting watching Rooster Teeth grow as a company.
Yeah.
And how their series have changed, because most of what they do is comedy,
mm-hmm.
kind of stuff, or comedy minded things. And as this is their first foray into a serious drama series, I hope that they do more.
Yeah.
They actually are. I think they just are about to wrap filming on season two. Of this.
That's very cool. And mm-hmm. And one thing I really like about Rooster Teeth is they definitely have a wide-ranging style of content.
Absolutely.
You know, even just like within comedy, you know, they've got their Achievement Hunter, their Immersion, their Red versus Blue, mm-hmm. a good smattering of different styles of comedy content, mm-hmm. but also their anime Ruby.
Yep.
And then, you know, their more serious stuff, which I'm really happy they're trying out, and mm-hmm. I'll definitely check it out. That's awesome.
Absolutely.
But that, what you just pulled up there is a perfect example of establishing shots, setting the mood and also setting, you know, the tone and thematic imagery that mm-hmm. we're going to understand later on. It's a great example and something that I think, I'm kind of guilty of not taking into account when I plan and shoot stuff, but it's definitely something I want to try and be more mindful of as well, mm-hmm. and learn from the greats.
Yep. Well, and I know a good example of one thing when we went back and did something, and I think I can say this, if not bleep me out here, because I believe it's in the trailer, but in the trailer for Dawn Under Heaven, mm-hmm. there's this dolly shot, and you see this rubble and burning things in the foreground, and you see the soldiers in the background. And that's a shot we did not have first time through.
Mm-hmm.
We had a very different opening shot that was more accentuating the scale of things, mm-hmm. and making them very small in this, you know, sort of crater, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, when we were going back through it, like, it wasn't bringing across this idea of desolation, of destruction. It was making them small, but not both. And so that was the new shot that gave us both this desolation and destruction that they are walking into, and also making them small.
Yeah, that's a great example. And I think it just felt flat originally.
Yeah, it did.
It needed a little emotion, a little movement to it. I'll never forget that shooting day, because we had just come off of helping with the Division shoot, the Corridor Digital shoot,
mm-hmm.
where we learned the technique of frankincense
yep.
For creating just beautiful atmospheric smoke. I think that's one of my favorite days of shooting, just because having come off this is during our pickups, having come off of main principal and having helped with the division and coming back, I felt like we had a different attitude of professionalism and just general different approach to the craft. As we get further and further away from shooting principal, I get more and more depressed because that was so much fun and we haven't released the film yet, but it will be out.
It's coming
in 2017. Damn it. Anyway,
gotta bleep that though.
Yeah. Whatever. Anyway. So that is our take on establishing, scenes within a frame. And I think, especially with that last example of Rooster Teeth, that pretty much sums it up really well. So next, we're going to be talking about a movie that does not do establishing shots well enough, and that is 2004's King Arthur, when we come back. So there's a movie coming out this year, 2017, called King Arthur, but we're not talking about that one. Have you seen the trailer for that one?
Unfortunately, I'll never get that 2 minutes of my life back again.
That is a very strange film. Yeah, Katie just peeked in with a disgruntled look on her face. This film, starring Clive Owen,
Keira Knightley,
and who's the... I don't recognize Sir Lancelot. I don't think
Lone he's... Guffard.
That's the one.
Mads Mikkelsen is in it.
Yes, the guy from The Departed, and also the
and many other films,
and the villain from Casino Royale.
Yep, Le Chief.
I forget his actual name, but he's in a lot of stuff. He's also in Hideo Kojima's upcoming game, Death Stranding, which looks very interesting. But beside the point, Clive Owen plays King Arthur, or Arturius, as he's also called in this film.
This is all based on the theory that King Arthur was a Roman soldier.
Right. Yeah, and this takes place...
Theory.
This takes place in the 5th century AD in Britannia, when Rome withdraws from the island to leave it to the Saxons. And the storytelling in this film is abysmal. It's one of... It's a tough nut to crack here.
We can as an establishing shot does, is of a movie, tells you the theme of the movie. Yes. The establishing shots here in this film also set the stage for how terrible a movie is going to be. The opening shot, obviously, you get King Arthur comes up on screen. You get some bad subtitle
for some reason, subtitles, and then followed immediately by voiceover.
Yes, and then you have Roman soldiers riding through the fog.
Yep.
And then
slight slow motion.
Then it cuts to an ancient map of the European area, and it's showing the Roman Empire. Then it cuts back to Roman soldiers running through smoke and flames or whatever.
Right.
And it's out of order. It is so poorly done. There is no, like, they should, if they were, if they had to keep the same shots, they should have led with the map to show the expanding Roman army,
right,
then cut to the Roman soldiers coming through the fog, then the soldiers in flames. That should have been the right order to do it.
Right, but see, so we're watching it now, and it keeps coming back to the map.
Yeah, it's like, do you remember? Rome's expanding right now, so we're going to show you with bloodstains coming across the map. Yeah,
basically the setup is Romans were fighting the Sumerians.
I don't even care. It was such a bad movie.
They conquered these like famous warriors or something, and so they like captured a bunch of them and were like, you're going to fight for us till you're 15, or for 15 years, and then we'll let you go. But... this is a really bleak setup, and then it cuts to 452 AD, precisely, because this is the village where Lancelot lives, and so we got Lancelot on a horse from a helicopter shot. He's coming home, and...
oh my gosh, in this movie, do they love, medium shots on people on horseback, and the bouncing of people on horseback.
Oh wait, is this... So it just cut to, I presume, Lancelot's father. I'm pretty sure that's the Blackfish from Game of Thrones.
There's a lot of people from Game of Thrones in this movie.
Yeah, so yeah, that guy is 100% the Blackfish.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yep, you're absolutely right.
I recognize that look on his face. Mm. So now we have the Romans coming.
On the horizon.
Now, don't you think it would have been a much nicer setup to like follow Lancelot for maybe a day or two, him talking with his family, establishing his lifestyle, and then show the Romans coming? Wouldn't that have been... a little cooler of a setup?
Well, no, because... well, obviously, don't you know why? Because he's not the main character of the movie.
Right.
So
no,
why would they
lead
with him in it?
I'm saying... yeah, that's very true. But it would still be better with what they did. Because, obviously, we still don't see Arthur. until all this crap is done.
We have nothing. And, you know, so they do this to set up Lancelot, and which would have been, like, it's bad, but it would have been fine if Lancelot was the main character, if it was going to be told through his eyes. Right. But it's not. It's told mainly through Arthur's eyes, and you have no background on Arthur except for a few offhand comments about how he's like a liberal of the era.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's a progressive.
Yeah. He believes all men should be free.
But what's weird is they're only taking Lancelot. They're not taking anyone else from this village.
Well, no one else is 15.
Oh, look how his sister's giving him something to keep that we never see again.
No, we see it one time later in the entire film.
That's so memorable.
And he's not the main character. We don't even follow him around that closely.
It's so by the numbers. Look at how much his mother was weeping in that, not at all.
Yeah.
His family.
Well, they all knew it was coming.
His family doesn't care. And then watch. Okay, so his dad and mom are like, okay, now she gives a tear. Okay, great. Good. He rides off. Joins the Romans, and they do this really bizarre battle cry that feels so bizarre. Hold on, let me crank the volume here. Wait for it.
We're gonna get flagged for this now.
Lancelot. Oh, and the music swells, and it's supposed to be dramatic, and you just don't care at all.
It's just the most awkward thing. It's not. The words are failing me at this point.
Yes, it's very awkward. It's an awkward beginning to an awkward movie. The cinematography also is tricky because they're obviously shooting in a beautiful countryside, and they have a lot of great costumes and set design, but the cinematography just doesn't do it justice. They cut between some wides and then extreme close-ups, and it's
there's no meaning behind it. There's so much dialogue that is done that is nothing but strict shot counter shot, like four in a row on horseback, and you know, camera shaking and the people are shaking, so it's a little annoying.
Yeah.
And so it's that kind of shot counter shot, like they do like four times back and forth, then they do like a wide overhead like crane shot, and then it's back to shot counter shot four more times, then another wide crane.
And the dialogue I will call clumsy at best, especially coming out of Clive Owen's mouth, who does not emote at all in this film.
His level of not caring is so high in this film. I think he could rival, you know, a lot of other actors.
Like, you know, your expression you have when you're in a work meeting and you're just listening to your boss talk and you're just like deadpan. Like, that's his face the entire movie.
Mm-hmm.
So we cut back to 15 years later and we have seven. We have Arthur and six other knights riding up, stopping, looking at something. They just kind of stop and this is the caravan. So they're meant to escort a bishop to the wall. Yeah. Why is the bishop going to the wall?
I don't know. I think because he needed to go there to tell him that we need you to go do other stupid things.
Oh, and he's also giving the discharge papers.
Yeah.
Why did a bishop have to
go? Well, I think that's, they make that as a joke later. It's like, you know, Romans don't like doing anything, not even wiping their butt without, pomp and circumstance.
But why the hell? So they have a decoy in this convoy. And it's good that they did because they were raided by these natives here. But it's unclear how so many natives got south of the wall.
Yeah. Well, and it's also unclear why there were why they even had, because they need to go north of the wall to save the favorite nephew of the Pope or whatever.
Right, right, right.
And there's like, why would he live north of the wall? Like, they would need to be constantly fighting off these guys if the war was as bad as they say.
So they have an ambush here by the natives, and they do such a bad job at setting up the suspense because they show like just straight up close-ups of the faces of the guys about to do the ambush.
Yeah.
How just like unsuspenseful is that? You see a guy here, close-up of his face with a knife in his teeth for some reason.
But and also a knife in the teeth is always a stupid thing, but also the blade is in like with that curve, like the sharp part is in his lips,
right?
Why?
Look at how foggy it is. Isn't this ominous?
Oh, there's so much fog.
And then we have,
like, they had like 20 million hazers going for the shooting of this movie.
And then we have Merlin, who is another native, and also Stannis Baratheon.
But also, that's another annoying thing, is like they try and make you feel like a shot should have meaning when it doesn't. So there's an excellent thing at the end of this fight. You have Arthur looking out into the woods, into just the woods, like just a wide shot of the trees and the forest. And then it's like a close up on Arthur's eyes and then a close up on Merlin's face.
Yeah.
We don't know where Merlin is.
Yeah.
We like, is this supposed to be some like existential experience of, you know, somebody is watching, but we don't have any emotional weight to believe that. Like, if that kind of moment happened 40 minutes later in the film, it would have been more believable.
Yeah.
But not here. It's like, where are you looking at? What?
Yeah, exactly. And then the, okay, there's no archers in this convoy, which is, anyway, sorry, we're really, this isn't an episode of How Did This Get Made. I don't mean to like go beat by beat in this movie, but it's just,
maybe we should.
Yeah, guys, this is going to be a 3-hour
episode. We should do the bonus episode of the podcast and we should just commentate on it.
Yeah. But no, you're absolutely right. And also, they try and do this very bizarre thing where Arthur is a Roman, but he has all black armor for some reason.
Yeah, and also how, so all the other soldiers, which are allegedly conscripted soldiers, they have to do this, and they're all wearing like unique armor, like from their homeland, and yeah. I don't see that.
Yeah.
I feel like they would have been made to, like, you're in the Roman army, you'll wear Roman armor.
Sorry, because we gotta get, there's so many more things I want to bring up, but like, God, they, yeah, look at, okay, so I just fast forwarded to a clip of Clive Owen's face. Just a random part of the movie, and it's just impossible to tell what's happening in the scene based on what he's doing. Anyway, we go to the villains, the Saxons, and you were meant to believe it's an army of thousands, and they're raiding villages, but it looks like them on just like a blank hillside, the same one we were just looking at, and you just see a lone woman, Briton woman, that they're trying to rape, and the villain, who's the professor from Good Will Hunting,
yeah,
is like, I don't mean with these people.
He doesn't talk.
What kind of spring do you think they would? And he just whispers the whole movie.
He has a little something in his throat.
Yeah, I don't.
Killer.
Yeah, kill him. You know, it's not threatening when the villain of the film just kind of like offhandedly whispers, "Burn the villages, kill everyone." It's like, oh.
And sure. Also, he doesn't look at anybody. He never makes eye contact.
He always keeps looking at, away at the, at the ground. I mean, I like the
nothing.
I like nothing. I like the Romans. I think they did a good job of like with their accents. They kind of have the Italian accent. They feel a little bit Roman, but they just, it's a very conflicted movie because so much of it is on the nose. You have when King Arthur confronts the dude, the father of the boy who they're trying to save north of the wall. He has these self-righteous like tirade where he's trying to tell all the commoners, you are free from your first breath, and this man is not of God, and we need to save all these people that he's in prison. It's like, you were not prompted to do this.
Yeah.
You
he is so self-righteous, it's painful. And yeah. You all, and like also with it being on the nose, like they pull out their swords the way, like, you know, I don't even know. It's like the person who has to point out his brand new iPhone every 5 minutes. So he pulls it out really dramatically.
Yeah.
Everybody pulls out their swords for like with no reason, no legitimate reason to pull out their sword other than shing.
Yeah, they keep doing that. And then he goes down to this dungeon and he saves Guinevere. Honestly, like the whole reason this scene exists is so he can save Guinevere from the dungeon. And they just beat up on like the pious monks who were like, they must die for their sins.
They're pagans.
Yeah, they're pagans. So he saves Guinevere, and this is so dumb. She doesn't have anything resembling what would be a native accent, like a Gaelic accent. She just speaks with a British accent because why not? And you think about, I had just seen Braveheart before rewatching this, and it's like they do such a good job of making sure everyone has the proper accents, you know, like the English high lords have a highborn accent, you know, there's even like slightly different Scottish accents that they have.
Yep.
And you know, the people from France have French accents, and it all makes sense. No one has this dumb vanilla white bread, you know, British accent.
Absolutely.
That's all pleasant to the ear.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that it's coming up in, so then them and their caravan goes west, I think, or east. It doesn't matter. They go east. And it starts snowing. Like, okay, it's getting to winter. Fine. I can believe that. Mm-hmm. But then they get to a lake that is frozen solid. And when you see it break later, it's clearly like 8 inches or a foot thick.
Yeah.
It's like, if you went north, maybe you could find this, but not if you go east.
Yeah, yeah. So hold on. Before that, do this dumbass flashback where he's talking to Merlin, where Arthur's a kid and their village is being raided by the locals, and he goes to this graveyard to pull Excalibur from the stone, which is his father's grave, and there's swords everywhere. in Graves.
And but I feel like they wouldn't do it. I feel like you wouldn't give up a sword. Because especially at that area, like a sword was everything. Like not just for fighting, but also like chop up some wood. Like people would use it at times for that.
Do they say, I'm sure they do, but when do they say that he has Excalibur?
I think the only time anything says that is in the very beginning, yeah. The very opening fight. One of the local guys that he's like, yes, kill me with Excalibur and spill my blood and make this ground holy. That's the only time they call it Excalibur.
Don't you love how emotional that was and how invested you were?
You know it.
So they go to this lake, and we talked about this when we were watching it, but they're so afraid the lake is going to break, but of course it doesn't.
Until
one of the knights decides to axe the ice, like with his battle axe, and that breaks the ice. And not only does it break the ice, it makes a chain reaction that that destroys basically the army that was following them. Blah, 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 blah. More stuff happens. They get back to the wall. And when they get back to the wall, which is probably like, I don't know, 20 miles, 30 miles away.
At least.
It is not snowing. It is not even cold. It's still green. Because, you know.
Very green.
There's a dynamic weather system here.
Of convenience.
Yeah, of convenience.
Plot weather.
Then Arthur decides to make a final stand to drive off the Saxons who are invading and charging on the wall. And Arthur has his Roman battle gear on, which is all black for some reason. Then he goes to face the leader. Oh, the door of the wall needs like five people and like four horses to open. And he's there by himself and he can just open and close it at will.
Yep. Even when there's no one there,
yeah.
He will just open as needed.
So he confronts like the main baddie. And he's got his Excalibur. He could kill him right then. Of course, that wouldn't be honorable. How could he do such a thing? And he's just awkwardly riding around him. And he's like, oh, and the way they like reveal Arthur to the main bad guy in the film, like they are just like racing towards this confrontation at breakneck speed. There's like a captured monk or something that the Saxons have is like their informer. And he's like, and there's like a lone rider on the hill. And he's like, who is that? And he looks around and he's like, it's Arthur. Oh, okay, sure. Why not? You know that.
And this whole conversation, when they're talking, it is the most obnoxious like circle shot because it doesn't stop.
Yeah.
Like it's constantly moving around and it's not like in like other like thriller movies, like this could work if there had been this constant like cat and mouse element that, you know, the game of war, if you will, mm-hmm. had been happening. But like, there hasn't been. Like, they encountered one other group of these Saxons once before on ice, and that was it. And it wasn't even an interesting battle or, you know, emotionally charged in any way. And then they have this sort of complicated, like, constant circling dolly shot with the horse freaking out because he's sort of doing Lipizzaner stuff circling around.
I think this movie just feels uninspired, and that's basically
another thing that, like, you know, as we talked about, Arthur has this self-righteousness to him, and he's supposed to be this inspirational leader, and like all his brothers in arms all really love him and whatnot, and they trust him and everything. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, they finally get their discharge papers, and some of them, some of them have families that either they have started here in Britain or ones in other countries or families they want to go back to or whatever. And they finally get all of their papers and are free to go. And they have this awkward moment a little later when like they have this like look at each other.
Yeah,
and they're like. And like without saying anything, they look at each other and they start smiling.
Yeah.
And then they get all this like exotic battle gear on, and then they go riding to Arthur.
And then they grab their weapons. But like,
there's no reason.
We were joking when we were watching the movie. It's actually their horses are freaking out. We're joking when we're watching the film. Like it's because the music was swelling. Oh,
yeah.
You hear that music? Yeah, yeah. It's time for a bet. And they're like smiling at each other, and it's just like, oh, your character motivation is suddenly the complete opposite of what it was this whole movie.
It's not, you know, get back to families or, you know, finally being done with the Romans, which we don't like. And now it's like, oh, we're actually going to go back to Arthur because Arthur.
What's funny is earlier in the film, Lancelot's yelling at Arthur, and he's like, I know I will die in battle, but it'll be a battle of my choosing. And then Lancelot clearly chooses to go fight, and then Lancelot dies in the movie, and Arthur's like, no, it was my life to be taken, but not this, never this. And I'm just like, oh, barf. So this actually happens more than once in the movie where they all look at each other and they're like, it's time to fight. It happens when they're on the lake. Mm-hmm. They all suddenly decide together without saying a word that, well, we can't outrun these guys anymore. It's time to fight. And it's just like, no, like you could keep going.
And it's, There are many, many movies that have moments like that that work when the characters look at each other and you know what they're saying
to
each other.
Yeah, but it has to be earned.
Exactly. You don't care. You don't care that they look at each other. And as you've been saying, Wade, it's so on the nose.
It's very on the nose.
Like, it doesn't matter.
Think about a kingly hero-like figure that you admire, that you would want to follow, that you're actually emotionally invested in, like Jon Snow.
Yeah.
Jon Snow is someone who, like, I would follow into battle because I believe in him mm-hmm. as a person and a leader because
of what he's doing. And yet his charisma, you understand where they're coming from.
Yeah. Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And none of that is here. Yeah. None of that is here. There is no... The script is terrible, and I will say the directing is terrible. Like, you know, there are many instances where, like, you know, Ian McKellen in Star Wars... Not Ian McKellen. Star Wars... Obi-Wan. Ian McGregor. Ian McGregor did, as an actor, I think did an admirable job with a bad script and a bad director.
Sure.
It can be done. These guys, bad direction, bad storyline... Or bad story, bad screenwriting, bad acting. Mm-hmm. Like you hit all the bad trifecta of it. Like there's nothing to be done to save this movie.
Yeah. This, and I just love it. In every fucking shot, there's just an abundance of fog in every single shot. Look at how much fog is just constantly.
Well, it is England.
sure. But anyway, so they fight. A lot of people die. For some reason, they let him through the gate because trap.
Yeah, because let's not use the fortification to our advantage.
No shit. They have trebuchets too, like a trebuchet catapult hyper.
Yeah, and they
don't use it until after they're through the gate.
And all the natives, like the wall was built to keep the native people north of the wall, the druids, if you will. Mm-hmm. And they all got south of the wall with all this war machines.
Yeah.
Like how did you get south of the wall?
Maybe the trebuchets were there and they just took them.
That's possible. Then how did they know how to use them?
You know, Arthur gave them training.
Yeah.
So anyway, they battle. A lot of people die. Arthur wins. And then immediately after that, there's a wedding between Guinevere and Arthur because we got to wrap this shit up and it's gotta get done. Maybe for a sequel. There's no charisma between Keira Knightley and Clive Owen. Zero charisma.
No.
Oh, sorry. There's a brief funeral for Lancelot. But after that, Merlin presides over the wedding. And he says, our people are now one. And then King Arthur draws his sword.
And he goes,
and everyone's like, King Arthur.
Well, he's like, now that we will have one purpose or whatever.
Yeah.
And he just yells and raises his sword.
Oh, and everyone's drawing their sword and it's great.
And it's like, so what is the purpose? Is it war? That's what it would say. Like that's what that would say to me. You raise your sword and yell. That means it is to battle, to war. Something like that.
Yeah. And then they shoot a bunch of arrows.
Yeah, they fire a bunch of flaming arrows because it looks cool.
And they show like 20 people shooting.
And then there's 50 billion arrows.
You look at the sky and there's like 6,000 arrows. Oh, it's great. It's good. It's very good. But anyway.
Speaking of British legend, we should totally watch like some of the Robin Hoods next. Like Prince of Thieves, Men in Tights. And Robin Hood.
Very good.
Just watch them all.
So, you know, we'll see how the new Robin Hood does in theaters.
New King Arthur.
Yeah, sorry.
Sorry, I confused
the
you.
The new King Arthur.
It looks terrible. That one, you know what it looks like? It looks like Seventh Son.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
I didn't see it either, but it's one of those ones where like it, or like also like 47 Ronin, where like it's taking a, for the sake of argument, I'll say historical story. Yes, there's all the thing about if King Arthur was real and blah, blah, blah. But for the sake of argument, a historical story. And then, like, adding in all this, like, high fantasy elements to it. And it just becomes a mess.
Yeah.
Like, the story, 47 Ronin is an actual story. That is a true story about a bunch of Ronin. So, samurai without a leader, without a shogun to serve. And it's about their shogun was killed. And then it's about them taking up arms and going and seeking revenge for their fallen leader and killing them. And actually the end of the movie is the 47 Ronin because they did bad things as Ronin killing themselves. Mm. It's a gorgeous story. And as if it would just been a historical movie, it would have been great.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's like there's dragons and flaming swords and Keanu Reeves is the great white hope or something in it. Like it's just
kind of like
blah.
Kind of like The Wall or what is that?
Oh, Matt Damon, The Wall. The Great Wall, Great whatever. Wall?
Yeah.
Of course, that one, that was not from America. That was never going to do good in America. That movie was made for Chinese audiences, and they put Matt Damon in it so they could attempt to sell it here in the States.
That makes sense.
Is what it was. That one, like more and more movie people are seeing the importance of the Chinese market just with the sheer number of people that are there. So they're doing more and more to try and capitalize on that market, because that market alone could, you know, equal or, you know, multiple times over the value of the American market.
That's very strange. And a good point to the greater trend of the industry, in that for the, I feel like it's my opinion, but like the first time maybe ever, considering the international market is overshadowing the concern for the domestic market.
Absolutely. And if you go to Box Office Mojo and you look at any given movie, like we always hear about, oh, what did it make domestically? Oh, it made $50 million or $500 million, whatever. But if you look at that versus the global market, like the global market is way much huge. Like, you know, you'll make $400 million here in the States and you've made $700 million in the global market.
And another interesting thing, we've been kind of against 3D films forever, personally, but we saw Guardians of the Galaxy 2, me and a couple of friends the other night, and we saw the 3D version, and walking out I was seeing all the posters, you know, along the hallway for upcoming films, and all of them were like in 3D, and I'm like, we've lost. The battle is lost. 3D is now the norm, because they have to differentiate themselves from, you know, what you can get at home on demand.
Another quick note on Guardians of the Galaxy. So that was shot on the red VistaVision sensor, really big sensor. And there was a friend of mine on Facebook, and he made a comment. It's like, Guardians of the Galaxy 2 looked so good, and it was so good to be captured on the VistaVision sensor. That sensor size, the scale you can capture on it was really good, and it couldn't have picked a better film for that. And my first thought was, what are you smoking? You're talking about a movie that was probably 90% shot on green screen. Why do I want a large format? Why would I want anamorphic or large format stuff on that kind of film? I want it on Lawrence of Arabia or Hateful Eight, something where it has stuff there that is worth capturing.
Sure.
Like, you could make a sensor, you could fake the scope of a scene if it's going to be on green screen. You just film what you want and shrink it down, and you can make the frame huge.
Of course,
no point.
You're referencing Tarantino, who would insist on shooting on film.
Yes, absolutely. Or also Christopher Nolan, Dunkirk is being shot on 70mm film. And 70mm Panavision, and then some IMAX cameras.
What I love
And look at the scope. Look at the trailers. The trailers are wonderful.
Did you watch the new trailer for Dunkirk?
Several times.
What I love about Nolan's films is he'll tackle different styles or genres and do them his way.
Yeah.
So like the superhero movie, his way, and everyone just like fawned all over it. And now it's like the war movie, his way. And it looks noticeably different, noticeably Nolan.
Yeah. It looks very distinct.
Yeah, so
I'm very excited. And that one is going to have some 70mm film projection things around it. So hopefully, I'm not holding my breath, but hopefully there'll be one in the area.
Hopefully, because we saw Interstellar.
Yep, we'll see, because if I remember correctly, I think they brought in a 70mm film for them for that movie. Like, they don't have one at that theater, at that IMAX anymore. Yeah, they normally just do digital.
Wow.
So I don't know if they've kept it, if they think that more people are going to be doing some 70mm stuff. I don't know.
It's crazy to think that, you know, in the early 2000s when digital was starting to become more prevalent, people were like, we'll never lose film, man.
Yeah.
Never. And now it's like all films are projected digitally.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Yep. I mean, even if all films aren't shot digitally.
Though if you want to try and find places where they're shooting on film, there is an app for that. I think it's like Kodak, like film something.
Yeah.
And it's one where like you can plug in your zip code and it will tell you if there are any film movies being shown in the area.
What I'm worried about,
nothing is showing up here for us.
What I'm worried about is maybe not film, but maybe like the theater going experience. I'm worried that is eventually just going to become more of a novelty or a luxury. Like think about stage plays. You could still go find a stage play if you want, but it's not as prevalent as it maybe used to be.
Well, it will be interesting. Well, one thing that is being discussed in that major movie distributors or production companies, you know, the big ones are talking about, is bringing in the ability to watch a brand new movie at home day one. It wouldn't be as much. It would be more than a movie ticket. It would be like $25 or $45. But you could watch. I'd be able to buy Guardians of the Galaxy right now and watch it at home. The big thing they're looking at is they need to figure out a security thing of trying to find a way to secure it as much as possible. You don't steal it, rip it or record it or something like that.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point, and I'm very curious to see how they adapt, because obviously on demand has obliterated the theater going
experience. It will be interesting because like it already does exist technically. If you are very rich and if you want to pay about $5,000 a month, you can get a... You can watch any movie first run in your home at any point.
Wow.
But like it's so expensive because they need to come in, like the company that does this comes to your home and has to install a server, a private server that is for the, you know, the movie distributors to, you know, they send their movie to that and then it goes into your system, but it's that way so it's secure and it can't be stolen and whatnot.
Interesting.
But yeah, I think it's like $10,000 initial like setup and then it's like $5,000 a month.
Wow.
To watch that. But even then with that, you still have to pay for each movie. So then it's still like $500 for a movie.
Damn.
So you do have to be rich.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you could afford that, you probably wouldn't even...
Yeah, you wouldn't blink. Expense. But you know, for me, like... A movie theater is a movie theater.
Yeah.
Like for me, like one of the, probably the most magical experiences for film for me was when I got to see Indiana Jones in a movie theater. Because of course I was born far after any of the original trilogy of Indiana Jones came out. And it was so cool. They were doing a marathon thing and I, you know, it was on digital, so I would have preferred it on film. But I got to go and see Indiana Jones on the big screen for the first time. And that was an otherworldly experience.
Yeah.
Like, you know, compared to any time I'd watched it at home on my dinky 42-inch TV.
You know, that's very cool. I'm sad that I didn't do the marathon of Star Wars leading up to episode 7 because I didn't do it because it was all 6 and I didn't want to sit through all that. Yeah. I guess you could come and go. But the idea of, yeah, seeing the original trilogy on a theater screen is really really cool in my mind because I've never seen it on anything bigger than, you know, a widescreen TV.
Yep, absolutely.
But yeah, no, I agree. I feel like going to the theater versus watching stuff at home is akin to maybe is a weird example, but going to a roller coaster amusement park and going on a roller coaster versus putting on the Vive, and doing a roller coaster on that.
It's absolutely.
Like, you could do it at home and it'd be fine, but you're not there like feeling the experience itself.
Absolutely.
You know, at the IMAX watching Guardians of the Galaxy, like there was parts where I could just feel like my chair shake.
And it's also one of our professors from college, Kogel, also had a good way of describing the importance of the cinema experience, and that is it is these discrete moments of time in a dark room with people you don't know. And the thing with that, like, unlike at home, it's like, you can't stop the movie. The movie's going to play, and then it's not over until it's over. You can't pause and get up and go to the bathroom or get food. Mm-hmm. It's there for those discrete periods of time, and you're in this dark space with all the surrounded by other people in a shared experience that, but you don't talk to the other people, but you're in this shared collective experience, you know, with all these people around you, which I think is kind of, which is magical, I think.
Aren't they trying to duplicate that experience with VR, like you're in a theater with others?
Yeah, absolutely. But it's going to be, you know.
Right, right.
It'll be like, I'll try anything once, but I don't know.
We'll see. We'll see where that goes. But anyway, that is episode 11 of the Indie Film Toolkit. Thank you for listening. Next time we'll be back. And I wonder if we should watch a true indie film, Voice from the Stone. It's showing
That's a great
in
idea.
Minneapolis.
That's a great idea.
So that is an indie film produced and directed by Eric Howell, a local Twin Cities filmmaker, shot in Italy, starring Emilia Clarke, who also is Daenerys in Game of Thrones, and it's gotten some, you know, pretty good reviews so far, so definitely want to check that out. We'll probably talk about that next time. Thank you for listening. We will see you next episode.